Well, thank you for rejoining us. I recognize that there was a bit of a wait on getting the sandwiches, so I hope everybody's managed to get something to eat. So next session is a panel. We're going to hear from Charlie Karamiris and Marcus Stanley. Charlie Karamiris is the Henry Kaufman Professor of Financial Institutions at the Columbia University Graduate School of Business and a professor at Columbia School of International and Public Affairs. His biography is there, and I'm sure many of you know him personally or by reputation. I got to know Charlie because he was, as I see he says on his resume, a member of the Pew Task Force on Financial Reform, and was a tremendous member of that task force that I think contributed a lot to what we managed to come out with. So I'm looking forward to Charlie's remarks today. Our second speaker will be Marcus Stanley. Marcus Stanley is the Policy Director of Americans for Financial Reform, which is the major public interest coalition supporting stronger financial reform. I had not met Marcus Stanley until last night at dinner, but then I did, and I think we will certainly have a lively and spirited debate in this session. So I decided to... Doug. And, oh, yeah, my colleague, Doug. Apologies. Who needs no introduction? And Doug Elliott, who you've met already here and has been writing extensively on financial architecture issues, financial reform issues, and is a former investment banker. So now I've gotten myself rattled, but what I thought we would do, since it's a little hard for people to see the TV screens up there, I thought we'd go back to the big screen. So we're going to have the participants stay down here. Charlie's going to talk, and then Marcus, and then Doug, and then we will convene for questions after that. Thank you. So, Charlie.
Thanks very much, Martin, and it's a pleasure to be here. So far, this has been a great conference. I hope I don't dilute the heady atmosphere that we already have. As you can tell from the title, my idea of talking about the future begins by talking about restructuring financial regulation. And you might think we just did that, but I'm going to take a very jaundiced view of what we just did and argue that the things that really need to be done, the most important things, we haven't done. And, in fact, you could even argue, although I won't spend my time on that topic today, that we've made things worse. Let me start with a prediction. My prediction is that we're either going to have, over the future, let's say the next two or three decades, sooner or later, we're either going to have real reform or we're going to have financial repression. By financial repression, I mean regulations that throw out the baby with the bathwater that we heard about from Bob earlier today and others. Because we can't afford to have the current status quo continue. What I mean by that is we're living right now through what I would call a global pandemic of banking instability. The U.S. financial crisis was just one example of it. We've had, over the last 30 years, over 100 major banking crises as defined by events that lead to more than 1% of GDP, negative net worth of failed banks. The average of that figure for the 100-some crises is 16% of GDP in negative net worth. By the way, the Great Depression in the U.S. was 2% of GDP, in case you want to have a little comparative there. And how much GDP was foregone as a result of the crisis, meaning as a result of the credit collapse and the recessions, the increased severity of the recession. On average, the World Bank's figure for that is also in the area of about 15% of GDP on average. In other words, we cannot keep doing this. We can't keep doing it in the U.S., in Europe, or in developing countries. And so we're either going to fix it or we're going to have to go back to a pre-liberalized banking system that's basically doing plain vanilla stuff that we don't have to have a successful and complicated regulatory apparatus to deal with. So what I want to emphasize is that that is not the best way. We don't want to go in the direction of financial repression, but that means we have to do real reform. I'm not going to spend my time talking about how we know that we have a problem. I just mentioned the 100 crises. But I am going to spend at least 30 seconds plugging my new book with Steve Haber, which is called Fragile by Design, which is a history for the last 400 years of banking and politics in five countries and explaining sort of how deep these challenges for reform are. The decision of instability is a political decision. It reflects the unprecedented protection of banks around the world that's happened just over the past 30 years, and that unprecedented protection has led to unprecedented risk-taking and losses. But it isn't just a simple problem of figuring this out technically and fixing it, because this decision, this political decision, is actually very deep. And so this book is all about, which I won't talk about today, how deep the political bargains go that result in banking instability. And I just want to emphasize, if you think I'm naive enough to think that politicians are waiting for smart economists to tell them how to fix the financial system, I'm not that naive. But what I do want to tell you is that if they were willing to listen, that we do have a lot to say. But before I tell you what that is, I have to tell you what I think the problem is. The problem is we're not credibly measuring things. And that's not just an accident. That's a political equilibrium. What is it that we're not measuring? We're not measuring risk, and we're not measuring capital. Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play? We have a risk-based capital system that we rely on for prudential regulation, but we are fundamentally not measuring the two components, the risk or the capital. And I want to emphasize, the problem was not that we need to increase capital ratios a little bit from where they were before. Let me point out to you that the Basel III capital requirements would envision capital requirements that Citibank was well satisfying in December 2008. So when Citibank was intervened, it had risk-based capital ratio of 11.8% and a Tier 1 of about 7%. So, as you can see, fixing the system by just increasing it by a few percentage points, the equity requirement, and going on with the same system doesn't work. What reforms have we heard about in the way of measuring risk? I would say virtually none. I'll talk a little bit about ratings reform. That's one of them. And what reforms have we heard about in terms of measuring capital? Again, I would say none. The key problems I'm going to point to are the inadequacy of measuring risk and the inadequacy of measuring capital, especially after a crisis starts and capital is really lost, but not recognized as loss on an accounting basis. So that's the problem. The problem is those two measurement problems, completely unaddressed. So I'm going to skip through my slides, but they're available, and I hope they'll be posted, and so you'll be able to see in more detail. And I've written all this up as a paper that's already published called Incentive Robust Financial, a program for Incentive Robust Financial Reform. So what I want to emphasize is that these two problems, underneath them is a deeper problem, which is that we have a system, a regulatory system, that has devised rules, and I would say on purpose, that are highly discretionary, and that they give great discretion both to bankers and to regulators, and that they do that on purpose because that means that the rules won't be enforced in a way that's politically inconvenient. By politically inconvenient, I mean causing credit supply to be contracted more than politicians would like it to be. So if we set up rules that allow discretion to decide what capital is and what risk is, and we depend on bankers and regulators to be the discretionary agents to decide what risk and what capital is, the world over, what we've learned in the past 30 years is they're going to get it wrong, and it's not an accident. They do it on purpose. They do it because of their incentives. What about bankers' incentives? Well, this is nothing new. If you haven't seen this cartoon, these new regulations will fundamentally change the way we get around them. This is the banker's perspective, right? So think Basel II, which, by the way, is pretty much the same as Basel III, where if you told your 10-year-old child, we're going to measure how much sugar you have taken in on a daily basis to control it. And then your 10-year-old child says, who's going to measure the sugar, Daddy? And you say, well, you are. They won't believe it, right? And yet that's exactly what we do. We rely on internal models of banks to decide things. But there's another agency problem, which is just as important, and that is the regulators themselves. And, of course, regulators, as I'll be showing you some evidence from about in just a minute, regulators systematically understated the losses in banks, especially in 2007 and 2008. And if that hadn't been the case, I will argue we could have avoided this whole financial crisis. So we have these two key measurement problems, and they rely on the fact that we're having two agents measuring risk and capital who specifically can be relied upon not to measure them accurately because of the political incentives and their own economic incentives not to do so. And so then the question is, can we solve this problem? And my answer is yes. The way that you solve it is by creating measures of risk that are immune to discretionary judgments of bankers and regulators. And secondly, to create, and this is a little more complicated, to create new kinds of capital regulation that provide strong incentives for bankers to, in their behavior, to raise capital when they suffer losses. I want to say that again. What we want to do is not just increase the capital ratio, but create incentives for bankers to voluntarily choose that they want to raise capital when they suffer losses. If they had done that in 2007 and in 2008, we wouldn't have had a crisis. So those are my objectives. That's what I want to do. I want to measure risk, and I want to create incentives for bankers to replace lost capital on a timely basis. Let's talk about, I'm not going to talk about all dozen of these ideas, but if you miss everything else, the key point, because I know I have limited time, the key point I want to make is there are a lot of good ideas here. These aren't really very hard. None of them is perfect, but together, they work together, I have argued, in a way that's very effective in solving those two key problems I started with about measuring capital and measuring risk. First idea, use loan interest rates to measure loan risk. I admit loans are only one piece of the riskiness of banks, but they are a piece. Suppose that we had used interest rates on subprime loans, that is, not the teaser rate, but once they are fully engaged. Suppose we'd used those interest rates to measure the risk of those loans. We would have required huge amounts of capital to be budgeted against them. Instead, what we did was we allowed internal bank models to decide the risk, which, of course, they decided was very, very low. So has this ever been done before? Yes, it was done in the 1990s. I was a participant in some of the regulatory reforms in Argentina in the 1990s, which were quite successful, which used loan interest rates for capital charges. The capital ratio in Argentine banks was a minimum of 11.5%, but it could be against a loan as high as 55% if the loan spread was extremely high. Is it true in the U.S. that loan spreads are good predictors of default risk? Yes, there's a paper by Ashcroft and Morgan that points this out. So why don't we use loan spreads as measures of loan risk? I guess we don't want to measure risk. That would be my answer. Second idea, and this was actually embodied in, to show you how bipartisan I can be, in an amendment that Barbara Boxer introduced to Dodd-Frank, which was defeated. The idea of this amendment was to reform credit ratings. And notice what we did in Dodd-Frank was we got rid of the mechanical implementation of credit ratings. But we didn't get rid of credit ratings. They're part of Basel III, and they're still being used. But they don't mean anything because they're still BBB, single A. So let me remind you, BBB CDOs in December 2005, at that point, had a five-year default rate from date of origination of 20%. And all the institutional investors knew that because it was public information. CDOs doubled in the year 2006, of course. It wasn't that people didn't understand that these were very risky. It's that they wanted to have an understatement of the risk. Why? Because their own capital requirements were geared to the rating. And if the rating was exaggerating the quality of the instrument, they didn't have to maintain as much capital against it. The rating agencies, and this is too long a topic for us to go into in too much detail, the rating agencies engage in rating shopping behavior for one reason, and that is that the buy side of the market is regulated in such a way that the buy side wants them to debase ratings. The buy side includes insurance companies and banks who benefit from debasement of ratings in terms of capital charges, and also other institutional investors who, for suitability regulation reasons, also benefit from debasements of ratings. What could we do to fix this problem? Very simple. For each class of securities being rated by an NRSRO, when we say that when they say single A, what we hear is that over the 5 years from date of origination, we think that is a prediction of a 1% default risk. And when they say triple B, we say that's a 2% default risk over the 5 years from origination. And if it turns out, we do a 5-year moving average for each of these classes of securities, if it turns out that for any class, what's called single A as a group by that ratings agency has an experience default history of greater than 2%, then that ratings agency gets a 6-month sit-out as an NRSRO. And if what it calls triple B over any 5-year period moving average has worse than 4% default experience on that moving average 5-year basis, then it has a sit-out for 6 months. In other words, we create an incentive for the ratings agencies to objectify the meaning of default risk in their ratings. Now we will have reliable ratings because the ratings agencies, if they have sit-outs, remember, it's not a guillotine, it's a sit-out for several months, they'll lose a lot of fees. This will also allow us, because we now have accountability, this will also allow us to be much more open to allowing entry into the ratings business because we have ways of measuring performance by ratings agencies. So, for example, I might start a ratings agency. In fact, I would. And I think many other people would, too. So we solve both the industrial organization problem of too much concentration in the industry and we make it credible and useful. Well, as I said, this isn't a new idea. We wrote this up, Barbara Boxer's staff and I, and it was defeated. And then when I inquired into its defeat, I was told the buy side hated it. I said, gee, must have been a good idea. So those are two ideas. I know I don't have – how much time have I got left, Martin?
Not much.
Okay. So – already? Okay. So I'm going to refer you to the other three ideas I was going to summarize here to just say, similarly, what they have in common is, if you notice – this is a particular version of how to set up contingent capital, where the motivation of this is not to do bail-ins, quite different from what Governor Tarullo was talking about. The motivation of this is to create an electric fence that really worries CEOs of banks and makes them, when they start to experience losses, want to avoid conversion of COCOs at very high market value ratio of equity triggers. So when the market value of equity gets below hits 9% on a 90-day moving average basis, 9% of assets, you're going to have a massive and dilutive conversion. That means that they will be targeting, like using a barometer, keeping their market value of equity ratio way above 9%. That's how you get them to replace lost capital. And I can tell you all about how much dilution was part of the calculation that led large banks not to replace their lost capital, especially after they saw the $10 share bailout of Bear Stearns in March of 2008. You can read all about that in a book that's right behind this wall called Rocky Times that Brookings just published, by the way. DeCaron and I have a chapter in that book. I do want to spend just 30 seconds on this graph. If you look over here, here's Citibank. Citibank in April 2006 had a 13% market value to equity ratio. And you can say, this is a 90-day moving average. You can see the crisis didn't happen overnight. Citibank's equity ratio declined. And this is all, every day, an opportunity for regulators to say, replace your capital, but they didn't. It's only when you get down to here in September of 2008, 2 years into that long-term decline, it's only at that point that we have a liquidity crisis. If Lehman had gone bust with all these counterparties having 10% or higher equity, there would not have been a financial crisis. There wouldn't have been a shutdown of the LIBOR market or the repo market. This was a match in a tinderbox. And the tinderbox is what all those graphs are illustrating. The markets were open. $450 billion of capital was raised between September 2007 and September 2008. The problem was banks didn't want to issue because they didn't like the price. That is a problem that can be solved by creating the kinds of incentives. So that's what our proposal is designed to do. I'm also going to point out, I won't be able to talk about it, another idea is, instead of the very convoluted and I would say wrong-headed liquidity requirements in Basel III, impose a large and remunerative interest-bearing reserve requirement of at least 20% of risk-weighted assets on banks. They have to be held in reserves at the Fed. No window dressing on reserves at the Fed, unlike, let's say, MF Global, for example. They held cash 4 days out of the year. Okay, I'm sort of down to the end here. I also have something to say about macroprudential, but I'm going to skip that. I just want to show you, I think that this is the conversation to have. Even if you don't like my ideas, you might have complaints about them. That's not really the point of my little discussion here today. My point is, anybody who wants to be a regulatory reformer should write down, right next to his idea, why market participants won't be able to get around it, and why regulators will enforce it predictably. That's not the discussion we've been having. And it's a discussion all about the measurement of risk and the measurement of capital. That is the discussion we have not had and we must have. Because, as I said at the beginning, what we really need to do is choose between a future of financial repression and real reform. And that is still the choice that we're presented with today. And what this means, of course, is throw the Basel requirements as they currently stand and the whole convoluted mishmash of risk weighting and banks' internal modeling into the waste bin. Thank you very much.
So I'm trying to find
I have to say, my name is Marcus Stanley. I'm the policy director for Americans for Financial Reform. And Americans for Financial Reform is the major public interest coalition working for stronger financial reform. And our membership includes most of the major unions, Public Citizen, Consumer Federation of America, a lot of public interest groups. And occasionally, when we lobby, we're sort of pointed to as the union-financed Americans for Financial Reform, who are supposedly radical. We actually get our financing from foundations. But setting that aside, I agreed with about 90 or 95% of what Professor Calamiris just said. And I think that that is a very important fact for understanding where the state of play is on financial reform right now. Because I don't think if you had gone back 3 or 4 years and looked at Professor Calamiris, obviously he's a very respected academic even outside of Washington, but at his participation in Washington policy circles, and you had looked at, say, organizations like Public Citizen or the major unions, you would necessarily have put them on the same side. But I think in many, many areas of financial reform, based on the things he said, we really are on the same side. And you could see the same kind of process with, for example, Tom Honig, who's the Republican appointee to the FDIC and is the supporter of many strong financial reforms that are also being pushed by people on the more liberal side. But the division here is not so much between the conventional right and left, but between people who are serious about reform and people who aren't. So I thought that was an interesting... Now, I was warned my second slide did not come through, or just came through as a complete blank. But what this slide showed was... I meant the slide to show what a transitional period of uncertainty we're in, and clearly it does that, that we have a blank slate that faces us. But what this slide was intended to show was that the share of finance in the U.S. economy has not declined since the crisis. And if you look from 2011 and on, the share of the financial sector, value-added as a share of GDP, has essentially not declined. It's flat at the level that it was prior to the crisis. The share of financial sector profits as a proportion of GDP has not declined. It's flat at the level it was prior to the crisis. So, and we clearly, there's clear agreement that we saw a major crisis that was driven by the massive expansion of the financial sector. That sector, the financial sector, has not been right-sized, and it's being supported by very, very significant government intervention. Over 90% of the mortgages issued in this country get government backing. The FDIC is still guaranteeing, through the temporary liquidity guarantee program, still guaranteeing a wide share of the liabilities of ordinary commercial banks. We still have a very low interest rate policy. There's just policy after policy, implicit guarantees from money market funds that are continuing to support the financial sector. And it's really, we're really sort of in a transitional point. What are we going to see? Are we going to see a shrinking of the financial sector based on a return to more traditional activities? Are we going to see continued growth? Are we going to see some form of stabilization? So that makes it's always hard to predict the future, but this is a particularly difficult time to do so. And we come into this period of transition off a period of really radical changes in finance, which were marked by huge increases in gross funding flows, huge increases in short-term funding. Bear Stearns and Lehman had average maturities of 3 to 7 days for their funding liabilities. Huge increases in international capital flows, international banking positions over 3.5 times greater in 2008 than 2000. The OTC derivatives market grows from 3 times global GDP to 10 times global GDP over this period. Growth in equity and foreign exchange trading volumes, that's a complement to all this. And we really haven't seen, with the one really significant exception of gross international financial flows, we haven't seen these things shrink down to size. So reinforcing or shrink down to what they were previous to that 2000 to 2008 period. Now, this radical transformation in finance didn't bring benefits to the real economy. The period 2000 to 2008, even before the crisis, was a period of extraordinarily poor performance in GDP growth and in family income growth. There's a really superb paper by Thomas Philippon of NYU that I recommend to everybody, where he finds that even the efficiency of credit intermediation declined over the last couple decades of expansion of the financial sector. In other words, the toll you have to pay to the financial sector per dollar of capital raised was apparently higher in the 2000s than it was 100 years before in the early 20th century, which is astounding when you think about the improvement of computer technology and information technology that should make intermediation easier. There's recent work showing that rapid growth in financial intermediation is correlated with slower productivity growth. There are manifestly enormous costs of financial crises. Professor Calamiris talked some about those. And even before and without financial crises, you get these distortionary effects on real economy investment of asset price bubbles and asset price manipulation, which I would argue has been enabled by these enormous growths in gross financial flows, in trading volumes, in access to short-term funding. And you could see a tremendous amount of malinvestment and misinvestment in housing over the past decade, even before the crisis. That was an economic distortion of the financial sector, even before it collapsed. We, without question, we've seen extraordinary events over the last decade. I mean, first we saw an extraordinary growth in the financial sector, and then we saw an extraordinary collapse of Great Depression magnitude. So how have we responded? You would expect to see a radical or extraordinary response. Well, Dodd-Frank is radical only in its length. Its length truly is radical. So I'll give that the credit. I'm going to go through and talk through this in a little more detail. But essentially, what Dodd-Frank does is it goes through and it has a section addressing everything you would want to address. But then, in each time it addresses something, it does so through a vague half measure that leaves enormous discretion to regulators. It's kind of a Chinese menu approach. You know, we're going to take a little bit of everything, and we're going to let the regulators figure out exactly how it's done. And the note here on market signals is this problem of regulatory direction, of deciding exactly how we're going to do and implement these things, it's not going to be solved by waiting for direction from the market, for the market to tell us exactly what the right or natural kind of financial intermediation is, because the market is so distorted by the presence of these implicit guarantees, first of all, and these implicit guarantees create enormous externalities. And those externalities really aren't measured when people are responding to profit signals. Or, you know, Governor Tarullo said today we have to look to industrial organization research to tell us the optimal size of banks. Well, industrial organization research draws on profit data from banks that, you know, doesn't include implicit subsidies from the public. It doesn't include externalities. And it doesn't include potential abuse of market power. So, you know, this is not going to tell us what to do. And of course, the other factor is we're in an extraordinarily low interest rate environment that is shaping and determining all the market signals we're getting. So unless we want to stay in that incredibly low interest rate environment forever, we can't be looking to the behavior of the financial markets right now to tell us what to do. I want to go back to the – or wait a minute. I want to take a slight detour into the retail consumer space for a minute before I get back to the systemic discussion where people really have focused with Dodd-Frank. But Dodd-Frank is stronger in the retail consumer space than it is in the systemic space, I think. And one of the main reasons for that is that it creates a new regulator, which has, I think, different incentives than the prudential regulators. And the set of changes, and I'm not going to express a view on interchange fees right here, but the set of changes on interchange fees, on credit card protections, on mortgage origination rules, and on the creation of the CFPB is a considerable hit to old retail banking models. But it still allows space for competition there. There's no direct setting of interest rates, and it's very questionable whether the CFPB could even directly set fees. And the CFPB regulation of non-banks in these areas could actually assist bank competition with some very high-cost non-bank financial services we've seen. And some of these things, particularly the mortgage origination rules, have the potential to really contribute to systemic reform. So retail reforms are on, I'm not saying they're perfect and there's still enormous regulatory discretion and complexity there, but they're on somewhat of a different track and offer some possibilities for intervening right at the origination of bad loans. But in terms of systemic reform, this is the sort of Chinese menu approach I was talking about, where you say yes to everything, but not really. And it was actually a perfect example when Professor Calmiris was talking about credit rating agencies. He put up there that you have to require credit rating agencies to predict probability of default and then hold them accountable for when their predictions are wrong. Well, you know, just as you'd expect, if you look into Dodd-Frank, you find your way to, I think it's buried there in Title IX, you will find the half measure, that credit rating agencies now have a lot of paperwork requirements to predict probability of default, but no accountability. You know, and that is entirely typical of the Dodd-Frank approach. And I actually was the Boxer staffer who wrote that amendment on credit rating agencies he was talking about. And you could very clearly sort of see the line where, all right, you know, if it's a reporting requirement, we can do it. If it's somebody that's something that is really going to cost people money, let's think again. You know, that's where the resistance comes in. So we see Dodd-Frank has many, many directives to tighten leverage and improve leverage. It even has mention of studying contingent capital in there. But it leaves it entirely to the regulators. And guess what? The regulators have gone out and they've written Basel III, which is just a marginal tinkering with Basel II. It makes some stronger definitions, stronger changes in the trading book. But, of course, you know, the line between the trading book and the rest of the bank's books are highly unclear. And it makes those changes by taking the same inadequate internal measures and doubling or tripling them. It's really pretty funny to read. It's like, we don't believe in value at risk models, so let's triple the output of this model that we don't believe in, and this will be your capital requirement. You know, I mean... It's kind of like taking your son's guess on how much sugar he ate and then doubling it because he's going to lie. He just might learn to adjust to that. It seems possible. Then there's a yes to some activity limitations. And I think this might be an area of disagreement with Professor Calmiris, but I think activity limitations are important because certain kinds of activity make it very hard to measure effective leverage or even, you know, what potential liquidity demands are going to be. So you have a yes to activity limitations, but the Volcker Rule puts in a whole set of exemptions for things like market making, which are really sort of an open field for regulators to define. They have, you know, complete discretion to define that. And it's very difficult for regulators to be tough, which we're going to talk about in a minute. Yes to removing implicit guarantees. We have resolution authority. But we haven't restructured the banks in a way that makes people really believe that resolution authority is going to work. And there's enormous discretion at the FDIC on the guarantees for specific kinds of liabilities. You know, it's still very difficult to say, well, what kind of liability is actually going to be guaranteed here? If I get involved in this kind of funding to a bank, is it within the government safety net? Isn't it? You know, some of that uncertainty is important, but some of it is very counterproductive. There's a much clearer yes to derivatives reform. I mean, there you do see some specificity. But essentially, all derivatives reform does is take two things, two directions the market was already going, exchange trading and clearinghouses, and mandate that it go in that direction faster and in a much broader level. And I think that's a very valuable reform, actually. But it doesn't go to there were no steps to ban specific types of derivatives instruments. It works really within the framework of that incredible expansion of the derivatives market that we saw, and permits that expansion to be maintained. Yes to oversight of shadow banking. It was very obvious that wholesale banking was going on through non-banks. But we have this slow and cumbersome discretionary process. We have to designate institution by institution, and you can't necessarily designate entire sectors. And we're seeing with money market funds right now, you know, when it's a sector, what do we do? You know, it's extraordinarily complex. Yes to compensation restrictions, yes to risk management. Again, a lack of clarity and a lack of follow-through. And you can add on to this. Yeah, I'm sorry. Accelerate. Yeah. Okay. So I think this is regulatory fragmentation is clear to people. And there's also ambivalence about trying to keep some of the benefits of those so-called complete credit markets and securitization markets that we had that did produce a tidal wave of liquidity earlier in the decade. And we also have this regulation happening in the shadow of crisis, that these relationships with these megabanks have been built up. And these megabanks became co-crisis managers with the regulators. And what all this has led to, the combination of the difficulty of regulating through this fragmentation and this regulatory ambivalence in a lot of areas, has led to a central role for stress testing, which is working institution by institution behind the scenes to try to get them to raise capital on an institution by institution level. And it responds to that graph that Professor Calamiris put out. We're going to spot it now a year in advance when you're running low on capital, and we're going to call your CEO. But it doesn't do systemic change, and it cements in place the oligopoly. So I think we face really, and this is the final statement here, that we face an important choice. Are we going to really do a serious reform that I call back to the future here, some kind of updated version of real functional control of the financial markets, or are we going to do a set of incremental limitations on the new financial model of the last decade? That's the direction Dodd-Frank goes in, and that's really a direction I think that's unless regulators get more serious about using the statutory authority they have under Dodd-Frank, it's a direction that's doomed to failure in a lot of ways.
Okay, thank you. And I don't have slides, so we can put the lights up, and you can just keep staring at the blank screen if you want. I'm actually impressed how many of you stayed here after Governor Turley's speech and after the lunch, so thank you for that. What I'd like to do is devote my 10 or 15 minutes here to pushing back against what I think are some misconceptions that I find all too prevalent in the debate on systemic reforms. Unfortunately, many in the media, political, and policy communities appear to have the impression that disinterested analysts have already firmly established that massive structural changes are needed, and that only entrenched interests have stopped such reforms. In fact, though, I believe that much more analysis is needed, and that much of what we already know argues against such radical changes. Now, especially after the last two speakers, I risk sounding like a mouthpiece of the industry for the remaining 15 minutes. So for those of you who don't know me, let me just briefly explain my background. First of all, I was an investment banker for about 20 years, so I am guilty of that, mostly at J.P. Morgan. And my clients were financial institutions. I provided strategic advice, M&A, helped them raise capital. Despite that, however, I've been a strong supporter of financial reform and remain so, Dodd-Frank, Basel III, and many of the other comprehensive reforms. I've done a considerable amount of work as an author or co-author on cost-benefit analyses that look at the economic benefits and costs of these global financial reforms, and have always concluded that, done properly, these reforms have many more benefits than costs. So let me be clear. I'm definitely in favor of financial reform. I have a number of concerns, though, about the structural reforms that are being proposed. And so what I'd like to do is organize my talk around as many of the 10 misconceptions that I'm planning to talk about as I end up having time for. So the first one, and all of these, or many of these, have been addressed to some extent by previous speakers, but an important misconception is that economies of scale in banking stop at fairly low levels. As was mentioned in the first panel, for a time, the relatively few studies that were out there suggested that above $100 billion in assets, there really weren't many economies of scale. And in fact, you'd switch to diseconomies of scale. And $100 billion compared to the size of our system is pretty low. More recent studies at the Fed of St. Louis and Fed of Philadelphia have found results that I believe are more accurate. And again, as was addressed somewhat earlier, show economies of scale that are much larger and go much, much higher in terms of the size of organizations. There's also an interesting stream of work by Ron Anderson and some other people at the London School of Economics. What they've done is to say, if you're trying to figure out what the economic benefits are of scale and scope, you need to look at all the places that the benefits stick. Many of the studies have looked at profit differences. That is one of it. Shareholders get to keep extra profits. Some of it is pricing. That is what the customers keep, and that's very, very hard to measure, is the truth, so there isn't much on that. But the other one, where there's some hope of at least getting a crude measure, is how much do the bank employees keep? And it's a substantial amount, as near as we can tell. It's very early days crude research. But when you add together those three places where the economies of scale and scope end up residing, where the benefits reside, it confirms my own intuition that these are actually quite large. And here I also go on my own experience as an investment banker to the financial industry. I worked with very smart clients and saw others who weren't my own particular clients who understood the industries well, who bet their own money and their careers on mergers that were predicated on very considerable economies of scale and scope. And generally that's what happened afterwards. They actually found those positive benefits. Now, some portion of that presumably is too big to fail subsidies that got bigger, but I'm confident from what I saw it was much more than just that. So whatever the economists have shown to this point, I'm quite confident there are large economies of scale. Similarly, a misconception that's sometimes felt is that economies of scope, the benefits of having a wide variety of related products, are either trivial or illusory. And I agree with Governor Tarullo that there is considerable evidence that these do exist. Again, it's something I saw working as an investment banker to the industry. And the Treasury White Paper from January of last year, which I wouldn't position as generally that positive towards large banks or the desirability of large diversified banks, itself concluded that there were some forms of economies of scope that clearly existed, some where they weren't so sure and some where they were pretty sure they didn't exist, but that there were important ones that do exist, and I believe it to be true. A third misconception to my mind is this kind of an implicit assumption that the structure of the industry is really best explained by what makes bankers a lot of money. And, of course, there is some of that. But it ignores what I think is an even more important aspect, which is customer demand. And I'll give you, first of all, a broad point on that. A lot of what's happened is that the large corporations that create a lot of the financial business out there, and increasingly medium-sized corporations do the same thing, they've been moving to the securities markets. And that has caused a change in the role of the traditional banks. And so I wanted to give you two points from my own experience. One, when I first started at J.P. Morgan many years ago, it really didn't consist of that much more than the Morgan Guaranty Trust Company of New York. That was a very highly respected commercial bank, among the large ones, the most respected in the U.S. It was profitable, fairly profitable, I would say. And management would have loved to just keep doing what they were doing. But they discovered they couldn't. The problem was they mostly had a customer base of large corporations. Large corporations were moving their business to the securities market and away from traditional credit products. So management was faced with the choice of either staying with the customers and expanding their product range or finding a new customer base. And they concluded, I think correctly, that it was better for all concerned if they could expand to continue to provide credit products, but provide them by helping with the securities market as well as direct intermediation. Another thing that was very clear to me, because I'd certainly directly experienced it, large corporations basically demanded that the firms they used for investment banking also lend the money. This is a big reason why the big commercial banks have ended up dominating, or at least their affiliates have ended up dominating so much of the investment banking realm. This was virtually entirely customer-driven. And we could have a longer discussion as to why they wanted it, but it was something they wanted. So the idea that the customers would be perfectly happy if we went back to the old model seems to me demonstrably false. A fourth misconception is that diversification at the big banks is effectively useless in terms of financial stability. And Governor Tarullo addressed this as well. Certainly, the crisis didn't definitively prove anything, and we could have a different type of crisis in the future, but it's interesting to note that the institutions that got in the most trouble tended to be the ones that were more specialized. They were either straight investment banks, pretty much, like Bear Stearns, Lehman, Merrill Lynch, or they were doing traditional credit products, Wachovia, Countrywide, WaMu. I certainly don't mean to say that the large diversified institutions didn't have their own troubles, but I think there's a good argument that they actually had some benefit from stability over and above whatever too-big-to-fail subsidies might have existed. Or I should say, I don't mean to say they don't exist. They clearly existed, separate from whatever the level of them were. A fifth misconception, I believe, is that there are people who believe the crisis would have been either much better or wouldn't have happened if you had simply cut the banks down. So if J.P. Morgan had been cut into 20 pieces and Bank of America into 17 and whatever. What I think that misses is the fundamental underlying reasons why these institutions made the choices that they made. My contention would be if you had broken them all up beforehand, you would have had a crisis that looked pretty much like the one we actually had. You would have had too little capital and liquidity at these institutions. You would have found them investing way too much in mortgage products, both commercial real estate and residential real estate. You would have found them taking trading risks they shouldn't have taken. They would have been doing things based on bad ratings. All the things that Dodd-Frank, Basel III, et cetera, are trying to fix would still have been in existence. And there would have been the downside that it might actually have been harder to deal with a herd of 200 troubled banks of significant size than to deal with a smaller subset where you could at least get them in one conference room. A sixth misconception is that large corporations will always be able to borrow. The Vickers Commission in the UK pretty much explicitly says this, that lending to the large corporations can be outside the ring-fenced depository-taking institution because big companies will always find the money. I am baffled by that one because we just went through a crisis in which it wasn't true. There was a period of time in which large, stable corporations had serious trouble borrowing. That's why we did the commercial paper rescue that we did. It's part of why the money market funds were rescued. We should be careful with any systemic reforms to make sure we don't assume that large corporations won't matter or can get the money on their own. We need to consider the fact that under at least the more severe crises, they may need the financial intermediation for them may need to be assisted. A seventh misconception is that securities markets can be disconnected from banking. It's clear that the banking groups that are centered around large commercial banks are at the core of the market-making activity these days. I think, though, that there are good reasons for this. One are the kind of the synergies I've already discussed, economies of scope and scale. But I also, and here I haven't given as much thought to this, but it has struck me more and more as I have started to think about it. Given how important the securities markets are in the U.S., we probably actually want them to have access to the stable sources of funding that come from deposit-taking institutions. How exactly we structure it, I haven't given enough thought to. But to go to the opposite extreme and to make the ring fencing so that the thing that provides stable source of funds isn't available to the market in tougher times, I think is asking for trouble. I think it could put us with more fragile and less liquid markets, which is the definition of increasing financial instability. I won't go into the next one or any of the next ones in much length since I know I'm running out of time, but one I would mention is what Martin started talking about at the beginning of our conference, which is I do think there's not enough attention paid to the benefits of risk management products. There seems to be two sets of arguments here. One set of arguments is that a lot of derivatives allegedly had no social purpose whatsoever, and I'm sure that's true of some of them. But since they didn't have a social purpose, we don't need to do anything to encourage them to continue, and if we take actions that will make them not happen, who cares? My concern more is that there also seems to be an implicit belief that many of the other risk management activities that take place using derivatives also don't have much of an economic role. And I would agree with Martin in what he said earlier. I think they do. Now, this turns out to be really hard to prove in an academic way, but I am convinced that the reality of it is that many corporations would not be taking on the types of projects that they do if they couldn't hedge financial and commodity risks. And that if we were to make mistakes that made it difficult to offer those products, I do believe it would lead to less economic activity, and that most of what went away would actually have been good activity. A ninth point, again here I'll reference Martin, there's a misconception that problems of interconnectivity have to be solved by reducing connectivity. Martin, again I'll credit, he has this great analogy with the electric grid, where you know a few years back we had serious blackout problems, problems with the grid, with the connections. Well, it turns out the way they've solved it isn't to decrease the connections, it's to increase the connections, but to increase the intelligence with which the connectivity is handled. And I'm not sure what the exact implications are, carrying the analogy over, but I think it's very much worth bearing in mind. And the final misconception, I seem to be on a roll here. Now, by the way, I work for Martin, so maybe that's why I'm bringing his name up so much. But there is that. He's the moderator, too. What I was going to say, he already raised this in a question to Governor Trillo. But there, I think there's a misconception that the transition wouldn't be very painful to whatever new systemic approach we have. We may conclude after more research we need to make some of these major systemic changes. I'm skeptical, but maybe we will. But we do have to accept that there's going to be a lot of pain and a lot of risk with that. So my overall conclusions are we need to be careful here. I'm skeptical of many of the proposals, and at a minimum, we need to give this considerably more thought and analysis, in my view. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to throw out a couple of questions to the panelists, and I'm also going to encourage them if they want to comment on each other's comments. I said I thought this would be a lively debate. I didn't quite realize it was going to be the center, in the sense of Doug, and the embrace between the left and the right, but maybe if we probe that embrace, it might split apart a little bit. Charlie, let me ask you, you mentioned that you had sort of proposed an amendment to Dodd-Frank, and you talked about using POCOs and improving credit rating agencies. So is your sense that Dodd-Frank basically is worthless, that we should throw it out, or are there a set of, if we were thinking incrementally, what would be the most important things to do to improve where we stand, given that Dodd-Frank exists?
Well, gosh, that's a big question, Martin. So I would say we're calling back to our days together on the Pew Task Force. We came up with some very specific recommendations,
right?
And some of those are related to the ones I've been calling for, but they have in common, all of the ones I'm calling for, are simple. They're very easily observable by outsiders. They're regulatory rules that have real effect and that can't be gotten around. And I think that's the real issue here with most of the problems in current regulatory structure, that they're just not credible. But I will point to one that I didn't mention that I'd like to get some discussion on, because the way I would characterize myself is sort of like the rabbi in the joke, you're both right, you know. the point I would make is there's reasonable disagreement about structural reform. I happen to be on Doug's side of that issue. I'm not in favor of changing the structure of bank holding companies in the United States. I think they're very efficient in structured the way they are. But the problem is I also respect the point of view that says, how do we know? And how do we know it isn't all driven by free riding? And so I want to tell you very briefly about a conversation. By the way, is this off the record?
No, I don't think you've been seeing stuff.
Okay, so I can't give the names because I'm pretty sure that the conversation was subject to Chatham House rules, so I'll just mention the conversation. So two very prominent advocates of reform who had a great deal of influence on the Dodd-Frank legislation were debating three other people, of whom I was one, in a closed setting, about the Volcker Rule. And I said, and another and the other advocates agreed with me, I said, look, if you think that the real problem is risk transference having to do with affiliates to banks, how would you feel, advocate of the Volcker Rule, if we set up margin requirements for the affiliates so that they have to meet the same margin requirements that a standalone would have to meet, so that there was no presumption of any free riding on the holding company or the bank? And these two extremely vocal and influential advocates of the Volcker Rule both said, well, that would be fine. Don't need a Volcker Rule if we did that. So we have not explored the ways in which, and I've talked to John Vickers about this and many others, there's a group of people that I think may not agree about what the outcome is, but can agree about how we can get to the answer. That is, if we can establish those kinds of mechanisms so that if there really is a synergy, those businesses will stay together. And if there really isn't a synergy, if it's just driven by free riding, then those businesses won't stay together. So that's the kind of simple rule I have in mind, finding ways to not just have to sit here and sort of say we disagree, but to say, well, how do we come up with a simple enforceable rule that will move us forward and preserve those benefits if we think that they're real, while getting rid of the potential risks? I think that margins used for proprietary trading would solve the whole Volcker Rule problem. We would not need a Volcker Rule if we used margin requirements on proprietary trading. That's an example.
Let me turn to you, Marcus. You argued that really that Dodd-Frank hasn't done the trick. We haven't right-sized the financial sector, to put it in your terms, and that the you probably said this explicitly, that a lot of what the financial sector does doesn't really have any social value, and so we need to get rid of it, and the economy worked fine before with a much smaller sector, so we should go forward for a small sector. But first of all, let me press you a little bit on that. I mean, one does make the argument sometimes the sector's gone too big. Many people, including me, say, good heavens, we're spending 20% of GDP on healthcare. Is that too much? So, you know, you're making that argument about the financial sector. But if we sort of downsize the financial sector, as we've done to some extent, aren't we going to cut off the folks that you don't necessarily want to cut off? Aren't we going to make it much harder for low-income folks to get mortgages, to get credit cards, to be able to participate in, to have bank accounts, be able to afford bank accounts? Aren't the people we're going to cut out some of the people that I suspect you would like to see being served by financial services?
Well, I think there are sort of two discussions, two big issues that I raised, and one you correctly point out is, do we need to shrink the financial sector? Do we need to right-size the financial sector? And the other is the adequacy of Dodd-Frank. And those are two separate issues, and you can have separate discussions about them. I don't know the right size of the financial sector, but I do think that in the kind of alarmism that gets raised within D.C. about, oh, my God, we're putting in margin requirements, which is a very radical step, and you actually impose them. There is enormous lobbying against them. And this is going to, you know, cause some shrinkage in some existing business. Perhaps we shouldn't be, perhaps looking at the history of the size of the financial sector in the U.S. should lead us to be willing to take some risks on that when we're returning to the size of the financial sector, you know, a decade ago or 15 years ago, when it was quite large, quite healthy, quite profitable, but significantly smaller than it is now. And I was struck by what Doug said about the risk management benefits of derivatives, which I think are real. I mean, financial derivatives, broadly speaking, you know, go back thousands of years and have been used for risk management. But you look at the increase in the derivatives market from, as I said, 3 times global GDP to 10 times global GDP in less than a decade, and you say, well, you know, were corporations not taking risks in the year 2000? I was there back then, and I seem to recall some risk taking. So you look at the scope. So it's not just the fact that it's large, but it's the magnitude of some of these increases and growths we've seen. And in terms of credit access, it's interesting that low income people pay enormous margins for credit in the United States, especially in retail products, payday lending and so on, which bring, you know, really quite significant returns. And if some low return activities were driven out, I don't think the provision of basic banking services to low income people needs to be or would be or should be one of those, just based on the returns it generates. In terms of mortgages, you know, this is something I'm speaking only for myself here, not AFR. There was the argument that mortgage credit was given on the wrong kinds of terms prior to the crisis. I don't know anybody who disagrees with that. And if we want to subsidize that kind of credit for people, let's make that subsidy more explicit by, you know, budgeting it in. I mean, this gets into areas that AFR is not taking a position on, but there are lots of ways to make that subsidy more explicit and budget it within government budgets. So I think those questions are going to arise in the debate on GSE reform and so on in the future.
Well, let me press you a little bit on that, because, the GSEs did start buying it with the securities that were backed by subprime mortgages. I know that they knew that they were going to lose money on some of those. And so the reason that they were buying that stuff and providing mortgages to people who wouldn't otherwise have gotten them was because Congress was pressing them pretty hard. And I kind of thought that organizations like yours were kind of leading the charge to do that, and that Barney Frank and his colleagues were telling the GSEs, no, you've got to keep making those that lending. So isn't it a little strange to turn around now and say, blame the financial sector for that?
Well, I really don't want to, because first of all, AFR did not exist at the time that this was happening. We were created in 2009. We've not taken position on GSE reform in general or on what the GSEs should do. So I just don't really want to go down that path. But the GSEs were followers, not leaders, of the private mortgage securitization market. And I think that's very clear from the data. And there were some very deep problems in GSE regulation in terms of you give an implicit guarantee, but then at the same time you set them up as sort of this weird public-private hybrid where they have a profit motivation. And they reached a point, you know, the GSEs were the ones who created for many decades a more stable securitization market. Then when you see these massive profits being made in the private securitization markets, you know, the GSEs, because of that profit motivation, followed in just before that market was about to fall off a cliff. And I think there were some real incentive problems with, you know, how the GSEs were set up that helped lead to that. But they were the follower, not the leader, I think. But this is not, you know, an AFR position or have okay. Said for the 14th time.
I probably shouldn't have led you down that road. But I'm not Peter Wallace. I don't blame the GSEs for everything that happened.
Well, but I mean, just as long as we're arguing about it.
You want to get in on it.
It's simply not true that they were followers. And that's based on flawed data that the GSEs produced. And, of course, they were sued by the SEC for those fraudulent data. And then in the SEC settlement with the GSEs just recently, the SEC concluded that they had $2 trillion plus of high-risk mortgages, which was a several times factor relative to what they had ever admitted. When you look at the turning point, the key was that the things that were being called Alt-A, that weren't being called subprime, actually, which were of very, very poor credit quality, really accelerated in 2003 and 2004, and the GSEs were leading that charge. So some of this is a little bit in the weeds of data, but I think it's absolutely clear, having read and reported publicly the emails from the risk managers of the GSEs, and you can find them publicly, I put them into a congressional report. It's absolutely clear that political pressures on the GSEs in 2003 and 2004 led them to make a dramatic change in their willingness to do non-documented lending. Absolutely clear. And they were fired. The one that wouldn't get out of the way was fired.
And the one thing I'd say about the following rather than leading, if you just set aside the Alt-A subprime distinction, if you just look at mortgage originations in the U.S. from flow of funds data, from lots of data, and what's special about the 2000 to 2008 period, it's the proportion of mortgage origination that comes from private mortgage securitization as opposed to, you know, bank origination or the GSEs. And that's kind of what I'm saying, that this is the, you know, but anyway, let's...
let's do a timeout on the GSEs.
it does hit the point, though, that we need to reform the politics of mortgage subsidization.
Yes.
And that's a key part that no one's mentioned before.
No, that's right. But let's move along to a slightly different issue. Doug, you're making the case that there are very substantial economies of scale, and yet they're sort of hard to measure, which I agree with. But one of the things that you mentioned is that, you know, you sort of say, okay, if there are economies of scale, where would we observe them? Maybe in higher profits, maybe in prices lower to customers, and maybe in higher returns to employees. Mm-hmm. I think if you are going to identify economies of scale that are basically designed to make the employees rich, that's going to be a tougher case to make against those folks that want to break up the banks or want to limit the size of the banks.
No, I understand that. And were I to analyze this in great detail, I'd certainly want to discuss at length the answer to the question you're asking, which effectively I think is, why should we care about those part of the economy of scale? My point is, economies of scale are economies of scale, no matter how you then divide up the benefits. So if we can establish that economically there are benefits to the size and scope, then we have a separate question of what we do on that basis. Do we think that the dangers that come with it are so high that we just let those go? Do we say we want to somehow retain those, but we want to make sure they're directed in a different way? So I don't know. I mean, there are any number of things you could do. And I will say there is some self-correction that's been occurring. Bankers are being paid a whole lot less than they were before. There's a clear trend there, and I think they'll continue to be squeezed. So to the extent that there are economies of scale there, I suspect more of it will be directed towards customers and shareholders going forward, but we'll see.
Can I see if we've got some questions from the audience? Yes, a question on the aisle there.
Yeah, I have a lot of questions, actually. Maybe I'll just bring a couple of things.
Okay, two short ones, questions.
One of them is, I think, that is important in this is, which seemed to be implied in the argument that that you had on, it seemed like you were implying that the crisis was caused because of financial regulations, you know, that maybe because functions were merged in banks, that's why you had a crisis.
If you're putting
who are you talking to?
Yes.
No,
yes.
That was not at all what I was saying. I'm sorry if I somehow led you to believe
next
that.
Question. Okay, next question.
Well, and it's related to this question of an economy of scale because, you know, people might argue if you don't have an executive and a judicial branch and a legislative branch that are separate, that you can have economies of scale. But that, like if you had a dictatorship, you'd have a lot of economies of scale. That doesn't mean it's a good idea. The problem with merging these different interests is because there are a lot of conflicts of interest. This is something that was exemplified in the PCORA Commission, which occurred before the Glass-Steagall Act was passed, that many of the holding companies, which used to have you know, commercial banking, they would transfer the losses from their investment in insurance onto people's deposits or the companies that held people's deposits. So that's where the problem was there.
Well, let's look, can we get into that? So the PCORA hearings accusations of conflict of interest, of course, have been completely discredited by all academic research that's been done on the topic. So George Benston wrote a whole book about the PCORA hearings and showed systematically that there was no evidentiary basis for the belief. And then we had a whole series of articles published in the top economics journals by people like Raghu Rajan, Randy Krosner, Manjit Puri, looking statistically for evidence of conflict of interest in very creative and scholarly good ways, and found very strong evidence against the argument. So I think that what we know really from the PCORA hearings is the political abuse of a crisis, which is what we saw in the 30s, and we've just seen again, which is people will make up based on their own hobby horses. And I can tell you, because I'm a financial historian, that Carter Glass, the reason that he wanted to go in this direction was because he was an advocate of something called the real bills doctrine. He was had been advocated since 1913, and to make a long story short, there isn't any macroeconomist alive today who believes the real bills doctrine. But the reason for the Glass-Steagall separation of investment and commercial banking was entirely based on Carter Glass's views about a doctrine that nobody believes anymore, buttressed by politicized nonsense from the PCORA hearings.
That's if you want to.
That said, I don't think that means that there's no conflict of interest today. The issue is not about what the PCORA hearings said. The issue is there conflict of interest today? So I was talking to one of my colleagues recently and saying, well, I really believe in these scale and scope economies. And he said, well, you know, I was involved in a hedge fund and I believe it's all front running, which is conflict of interest. So I don't dismiss the argument. We don't know, and part of the reason we don't know is because we don't have data on things that would allow us to know.
You don't have to look to the PCORA hearings. You can look to Senator Levin's subcommittee on investigations hearings right before Dodd-Frank. On some of the gold, on some of the Goldman Sachs securitizations, to see some conflicts of interest. I do think that this assessment of the 1930s reforms, which Professor Calamiris is giving, does help, highlight some of the differences in opinion. That I think that's a very common view on things, in like Glass-Steagall, among a lot of academics, especially mainstream academic economists, that Glass-Steagall was a mistake for a lot of reasons. When you look back at the history and legacy of Glass-Steagall, though, and Glass-Steagall was something that was a very powerful and radical step taken, I won't say on a flyer. I think that there were a lot of ideological justifications and reason for it, and I think the real bills doctrine, while it's discredited in some ways, points to some really important questions about how you back up speculation and finance that continue to exist. But Glass-Steagall was not the, whether you think it was optimally efficient or not, it was not the disaster that certain academic economists would have you believe it is based on pure theory. I mean, the U.S. economy grew for many years with higher GDP growth than we did under the period of, when we were moving toward consolidation and universal banking. Under Glass-Steagall, we created the most competitive investment banking sector in the world under Glass-Steagall, in part, I think, because of pressures toward specialization that were created in Glass-Steagall. So the result and impact of Glass-Steagall is not something I think that can be dismissed at all in terms of the benefits that occurred from it.
But what about the cost? So for example, as late as the 1950s, Congress established a task force to try to figure out how in the world can we get equity finance to happen for small companies in the U.S. because it had dried up. Actually, in the 1920s, under the leadership of Lehman and Goldman Sachs, we started to see some major development of IPO financing in the U.S. I would say Glass-Steagall pretty much stopped it. And we didn't get back to it until the institutional investor revolution of the 1960s and 70s, which created roadshows and a whole different mechanism for doing IPOs and seasoned equity offers. The U.S. has been a backward corporate financing platform, especially for securities offers and equity, really throughout its entire history, owing to some of the regulatory problems. And the consolidation movement, the 1930s stopped the consolidation movement of banking, stopped the economies of scope, and financial historians looking back on that say it cost us decades in terms of the efficiency for customers of certain banking products. I think that's what we are in the middle of doing right now. Again, I don't want to prejudge it. I want to establish what we can agree on are safeguards against risk transference and then let the banks structure themselves in a way that we can agree will be based on a true market test.
And
we don't have to agree, right?
This is just the debate I expected, but I do want to bring the audience into it a little more. So, Jamil,
thank you.
Professor Calamiris, I want to something that you mentioned regarding the role of NSROs in regards to the crisis, and I wanted to know your thoughts on the accusation that what some of the creators and sellers of the collateralized debt obligations, that what they had done was hired out of the NSROs, and in putting them together, in essence, said, as an expert, what are you going to be looking for to make this a double A or single A or A-rated obligation? So when we go back and show them, you'll know what it is. We'll be able to know what it is they're looking for, so it'll get the proper rating.
Well, I think it was even easier than that. Rating shopping happens in the following way. You didn't have to hire someone to do that. What you do is, if you're the originator of a securitization, you go to the three ratings agencies, knowing you're going to drop one of them, and you say, what proportion of this pool are you going to rate AAA? And one says 70, one says 72, one says 75. Then you only ask the two that said 72 and 75 to do the rating. So it wasn't hard, given the way rating shopping worked. You didn't have to hire someone to advise you. You just had to have a simple algorithm, which is pick the ones that are going to give me the best ratings, and I can drop one. And what we see is a lot of evidence. I've done some work in looking at these, a lot of evidence that this wasn't a random process either. So, for example, Fitch was pretty much the bottom feeder in this process. Moody's tended to be the one that was left out the most. Standard & Poor's came in second. Fitch hardly ever.
And can I jump in and also say, what you just described, I don't see anything wrong with. The rating agencies should have been clear enough that you didn't need to hire an expert to decode how they thought. But it's a little bit like with lawyers. You hire lawyers because our laws are so complex, you need somebody who actually understands them to figure out what to do.
I can take one more question at the back there, and then I'm going to turn this over to Don Cohen, who's going to conclude the proceedings.
Thanks. Justin Friedman with the American Financial Services Association. We represent consumer creditors. My question is, if there is this concern about deposit-taking, subsidizing risky activities, then could you assess the usefulness and effectiveness of Dodd-Frank's reforms to deposit insurance? And is that part of the solution? Is that much of the solution? And what else needs to be done if that's a persistent concern, without expressing any bias about whether that is a valid concern?
You've been very critical of mortgage insurance, right? So you think it's gotten worse? Or
deposit insurance.
Deposit insurance, excuse me.
Well,
I
think that I'll only answer the question very briefly to point out one thing. Virtually all deposits in the United States are insured. If you had a $50 million deposit that you wanted to get insured, no problem. You just go to one bank even, and one account. You no longer need to have a bunch of different accounts in a bunch of different banks because Alan Blinder invented something called CDARS. So I have personally set up these accounts myself, and I can have a virtually unlimited amount swapped out through a CDARS account and have the convenience of all one account. So this is one of the things that I guess serving the Federal Reserve Board gets you to understand how to arbitrage the system even better than the bankers. So we have 100% deposit insurance in the United States right now. Except if you're not smart or clever enough or knowledgeable enough to have done it. In other words, it's basically regressive in its impact. In terms of reform of deposit insurance, I would say what reform of deposit insurance comes down to is internalizing risk in the banks, making banks have to act as if their risk is measured and their capital is measured adequately. And if that's not happening, then deposit insurance is still a free ride. I'm afraid that that's where I think we are. So I don't think there's any credible reform of the risks associated with deposit insurance or the broader safety net so long as we don't have credible prudential regulation.
Any final comments? Doug? Marcus? Would you like to get rid of deposit insurance? I would not.
No, it's a red
herring. Final comment on what Doug said. One point I sort of tried to get at in my slides but didn't in my discussion as much is that there can be sort of a moderate argument for Dodd-Frank, which says that Dodd-Frank doesn't require fundamental structural change, but it goes through and puts moderating safeguards in sort of an incremental sense on each different activity. And from that standpoint, Doug sounded to me like a defender of Dodd-Frank, and I think there is sort of a moderate claim for Dodd-Frank that can be made to work that way.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody on the panel.
Let's talk more about
definitely.
Greetings, everyone, and the fact that there are this many people here is a testament, I think, to the very, very nice program that Doug and Martin put together. They've given us a very rich array of presentations, plenty of arguments and discussions, and a long to-do list for Brookings to follow up on, and I think it's been a very, very productive day here at Brookings. My role is to conclude the conference. I am not going to try to do the impossible and summarize what we all heard today. I'll have a few comments of my own, a little bit different perspective, pointing out one or two things. It'll overlap with some of what we've heard, but I hope from a little bit different angle. So let me try that for just a few minutes. I start by noticing and bringing to your attention the two objectives for the financial system that are embodied in the title of the conference, Structuring Financial Sector to Enhance Growth and Stability. We want a financial system that rewards savers, channels savings to creditworthy borrowers in ways that enhance efficiency and promote economic growth, that supports innovation in the financial sector, but even more importantly, innovation in the private sector that will increase productivity and growth. But we also want a financial system and need a financial system that promotes and supports economic stability, a financial system that's robust to shocks without taxpayer support, firms that can fail without endangering the real economy, a financial system that limits the inherent cyclicality that it embodies both on the way up and the way down, promoting much stronger growth and then weaker recessions than otherwise would be, and doesn't make business cycles worse. We certainly did not have that financial system in the years leading up to and in the financial crisis. As several people have pointed out, we had a financial system that encouraged the oversupply of housing and household debt, and in particular located a lot of that household debt in households that couldn't afford that debt. A financial system that itself became quite vulnerable and unstable with increased leverage, greater maturity transformation, borrowing short. Several people, including Governor Tarullo, had highlighted the increased importance of the wholesale funding markets, supporting and funding longer-term, less liquid assets. And the financial system had become increasingly pro-cyclical. The vulnerabilities in the financial system exacerbated the cycle that resulted from the destruction of household wealth and the overhang of debt when the housing when the housing bubble collapsed. Now, the response to the crisis has naturally, in my view, concentrated on building stability of those two objectives. And we just had a discussion about whether it's been successful or is likely to be successful with that, but I think that's been the concentration. And I think there's some potential tensions between the two objectives. We need to be careful about defining them. So a completely stable system, one that didn't have much, if any, maturity transformation or leverage, wouldn't be able to meet public demands for lending and borrowing or fund the many projects that would foster economic growth. Now, in the long run, there's no trade-off between a sort of a sensibly stable financial system and economic growth. We're just finding out right now over the last 4 or 5 years that an unstable financial system is bad for growth and bad for the economy. So the two need to go together. But building that sensibly stable system can involve short- to intermediate-term trade-offs. Building stability has costs that can impede escaping from the recession. And the conference, in my mind, particularly the title of the conference, Structure in the Financial Sector, raises the question about what can be done on the structure side to achieve both goals, to reduce the tensions. And the prism I want to come at it through is the prism of competition. So how can we increase competition in the financial sector? The effect of these regulations on competition should be part of the cost-benefit analysis that we engage in as we think about these regulations. Cost-benefit has come up in several of our discussions, but I haven't heard any real focus on what's this going to do to competition in the financial sector. The banking system has become much more concentrated over the last few years leading up to the crisis, and it became even more concentrated in the crisis as strong institutions bought up weak and weak ones went out of business. In my remarks, I'll concentrate on the U.S., but we certainly saw in the first set of slides from Nicola and others that concentration in the U.S. might have increased, but it's nothing like concentration in other countries. So I think all these issues come up in even more intense and important form for other countries. Greater competition potentially would reduce dependence on a few large important institutions, that is, reduce the too-big-to-fail problem, would reduce the oligopoly profits that these institutions may earn, as well as the too-big-to-fail profits, increase options for funding growth, and increase the efficiency of the system and make it more resilient by having many more options for both savers and borrowers. But all this is potential, so increased competition could potentially do this. It needs to be guided and developed in the right way. And I'll concentrate on mention three different types of competition or three sources of additional competition. Competition in the banking industry, competition in the U.S., competition with foreign competition between foreign competitors in the U.S., and then competition with non-bank or market intermediation functions, encouraging them. So within the banking industry and promoting competition there, I agree with so many people that have spoken today that the most important thing we can do is to deal with too big to fail, to eliminate the subsidy. Now, there are a number of efforts underway which I think are beginning to bear fruit but haven't been fully realized, as Governor Tarullo said, trying to make these institutions much less likely to fail with greater capital and liquidity, therefore the subsidy is much less, and then also to create a way of resolving them, of having them fail, with risk to the creditors. And he mentioned the single point of entry and at least putting the creditors, the holding company, at risk, so that no institution in the end should be too big to fail. There are a lot of challenges here, and he highlighted a number of them. There are great, difficult international coordination challenges, but we've made some progress. So what further, we also heard from him some ideas on some further steps that might be taken to deal with too big to fail. We just heard a long debate about breaking up the banks, the reinstituting Glass-Steagall. My personal view is that that's probably not a good idea, that there are some, first of all, a lot of the problems that we experienced in the crisis occurred in pieces that wouldn't have been affected by Glass-Steagall, Bear Stearns, Lehman, AIG, et cetera. Secondly, there are some advantages of scope for customers of having these different functions in the same place. So there are some synergies here that would be difficult, and I think we should try and keep if we possibly can. Now, it's true that I supported the Vickers Commission suggestions in the United Kingdom in my position on the Financial Policy Committee there, but I think they're somewhat different. First of all, the Vickers Commission would keep both pieces in the same holding company, so you get the diversification in some of the economies of scope. The UK banking systems we saw on the charts is much more highly concentrated than the U.S., banking system, and breaking these things, putting the holding company structure in place and putting some pieces under the holding company would very much help with this resolution problem. We already have holding companies in the U.S. we can work on like this, but they don't so much in the United Kingdom. And it also would enable the authorities in the United Kingdom to impose higher capital requirements, especially on the domestic ring fence piece that wasn't in competition with other international service providers. So I think Vickers was a good idea for the United Kingdom, but it's not the same as reinstituting Glass-Steagall, and I don't think reinstituting Glass-Steagall would be in the public interest in the United States. The second point that Dan Tarullo mentioned was size limitations. And there's a little more appeal to me from this on this one, that is, put size limitations on, let the bankers decide how to cope with them. I would say two points that make me hesitant here. One is we're already getting changes in banking business lines and business models from the liquidity, capital, and other regulations we're putting into place. It's not clear that we need to do this yet. And the second point is I wonder about what the effect, the cost would be on the competitive incentives for large banks. So if you knew you were getting close to the ceiling, you wouldn't be competing for new business so hard. So through my prism of competition, I have some concern that a cost of these size limitations would be reduced competition, at least in the intermediate and short run, until those smaller institutions got larger in the United States. I think we need to recognize that cost in the further study that Governor Tarullo was talking about. Second angle is allowing foreign competition to the extent in the U.S., to the extent consistent with U.S. financial stability. The key issue here is subsidiarization of host country activities. Do we make the foreign activities, put them in a separate subsidiary? There's a lot of appeal here. It helps with resolution. It helps with stability. We can make sure that foreign companies here don't threaten, we'd be better sure they don't threaten U.S. domestic financial stability. But once again, I think there are some costs here. It will reduce the ability of banks to distribute savings efficiently around the globe. And I think there is a risk of impinging on competition here from foreign banks for domestic banks unless we're very, very careful about what's required, where it's required, and that we don't make this an excuse for disadvantaging foreign banks relative to domestic banks. My third point on competition is promoting non-bank or market intermediation functions in competition with banks. Securities markets and securitization markets can provide important alternatives to banks and competition for even the largest banks. Having both bank and market intermediation had been considered a strength of the U.S. financial system, but in the crisis, of course, the so-called spare tire was also flat in addition to the four major tires. I think a couple things happened that undermined the ability of the securitization process to provide that spare tire. There was a growth of bank-like maturity transformation, this borrowing short, lending long, in the non-bank, in the securities market, in the so-called shadow banking sector, without a bank safety net or without oversight for the banking system. The money market funds, tri-party repo, securities lending, these were all ways of borrowing very short with so-called safe obligations financing less liquid assets. And secondly, there were greater and more opaque interconnections between the securities markets, securitization markets, the shadow banking system, and the commercial banking system. Think about those asset-backed commercial paper conduits and about the sieves that looked like independent, but they weren't really. They were backed up by the liquidity and sometimes capital insurance of the commercial banking system, explicit or implied. So problems in the shadow banking system quickly migrated to the commercial banking system. What do we need to do? I think we need to strengthen shadow banking, reduce the vulnerabilities while preserving some of the less risky functions for financing securities activities in banks, and there have been suggestions made on money market funds and overnight and tri-party RP, as we've already heard. We need to restart securitization markets, especially, I would say, for the private label mortgages to diversify away from the GSEs, make sure there are more alternatives for people to borrow mortgages. So we need to complete the rulemaking in this area so the private sector knows what the rules of the road are and can start operating there. We need to recognize the importance of support from banks and from banks and others for securities activities and market-making efforts that Doug referenced in his comments. And we need to simplify and make more transparent some of these interconnections between banks and non-banks so that people aren't fooled the next time, so both the regulators and the public and the people dealing the counterparties know where these interconnections are. And there's a number of efforts under Dodd-Frank underway in that regard, the use of central counterparties, clearing organizations, and greater much for derivatives so that everybody has the same counterparty, much more transparency in the derivative and other areas as well. So I think we're trying to address this issue as well. So as I said, most of the focus of regulatory efforts has been on reining in risky activities. That's critical. But we need to think about the interaction with competition, how we can promote more competition in markets to have both growth and stability. I think this conference has helped to clarify a number of aspects of financial reform that affect the ability of the financial sector to foster growth and stability, a huge agenda for further work. I think we owe a great deal of thanks to Doug and Martin for the program they put together. So thank you, guys.